relations, universal relations for neutrons that have been found recently, and how we can apply these relations to fundamental physics. So this is the introductory slide of myself. I don't know how many of you have been to Japan before, but I was born in a city next to Tokyo. It's called Chiba. Chiba is famous for Tokyo Disneyland, although the name says Tokyo Disneyland, it's actually in Chiba Prefecture. And Chiba is also famous for production of peanut beans, not the cartoon, but the actual beans. And then I moved to Kyoto. That's where I met Luis and Eric and Soichiro for the first time. And I got my PhD there. And as you may know, Kyoto has many beautiful temples and shrines. So if you haven't been there, you should go there, definitely. And after I got my PhD, I moved to Montana State University to do my first postdoc. There I was working with Nico Yunes mainly. And there I was surrounded by beautiful lakes and mountains and wild animals. I guess this is similar to Canada, maybe. I don't know.
So your pets?
Pets? Pets?
Bears.
Bears? I only saw bears in national parks like Yellowstone. And now I'm at Princeton University. I just moved there, and my new supervisor is Franz Pretorius. So what do I work on? I work on two main topics. One is testing strong field gravity using current binary pulse observations, and also future gravitational wave observations. And for this one, I have looked at a bunch of different theories, non-GR theories, and in certain cases, we managed to place very strong constraints, like order of magnitude stronger than those previously found. But today's focus is on this second point. I'm also interested in studying neutron star properties within GR, in particular, looking at universal relations among certain neutron star observables that do not depend strongly on its internal structure. And I'm also interested in looking at approximate no-Hare-like relations for neutron star multiple moments that resemble the well-known black hole relation, black hole no-Hare relation. All right, so for those of you who are not familiar with neutron stars, I made one introductory slide for neutron stars. They are final fate of massive stars. And although the name says neutron stars, they consist of not only neutrons, but also protons and electrons and muons, and probably some others like exotic matter, hyperons or kaons or some others. But we don't really know what the internal structure is due to the uncertainty in the nuclear physics, so we don't know the correct equation of state at supranuclear density. So we don't know what's going on inside a neutron star, but we kind of know that there must be a crust, because we know the crust equation of state quite well thanks to the ground-based experiments. But we don't know what's going on in this core region here. Now, for basic properties, the mass of a neutron star is typically the same as that of a sun, but the size is very small. Its radius is typically like 12 kilometers, which I suppose is shorter than the distance from here to Guelph. So imagine you compress a sun to a size that's comparable to the distance from here to Guelph. That means neutron stars are very, very compact. If you calculate dimensionless compactness, that is a ratio between mass and radius, then typically neutron stars have a compactness of 0.1. If you compare this against the black hole, non-rotating black hole compactness, which is 0.5, then you can see that they are very similar. If you compare this 0.1 to the solar compactness, which is 10 to minus 6, then you know that neutron stars are very, very compact compared to these ordinary stars. And thanks to this unknown internal structure, and also due to this strong compactness, we can do interesting things by looking at neutron stars. So for me, there are at least two motivations for considering neutron stars. One is on probing nuclear physics. So as I said, we don't know what's going on inside neutron stars. That means by observing neutron stars with like X-ray observations or radio telescopes, then we can go into the internal structure, and we can extract the internal structure information or equation state information for supranuclear matter. One way to do this is to use future gravitational wave observations. I'm going to show you two simulations done by Kenta Hotokezaka. Imagine you have two neutron stars orbiting around each other, and they emit gravitational waves. The top one has a rather stiff equilibrium state, which means that you have a neutron star that has larger radius compared to the soft equilibrium state, which is shown in this bottom simulation. He picked the masses to be 1.2 and 1.5 solar masses. So here, the simulations. And you will see that the gravitational waves look quite different. The only difference here is the equilibrium state, where you pick stiff one or soft one. And you can see that already the stiff one has merged, whereas the soft one hasn't merged yet. You can see that there's difference here, which means that if you can detect such gravitational waves, then you can extract information about this equilibrium state in future. Okay, I'm gonna stop the simulation here. This is using gravitational wave observations, but we can actually probe internal structure with current observations using, for example, X-ray observations. This is the famous mass radius relation for a neutron star with various equilibrium state. And you can see that this relation depends very strongly on which equilibrium state you pick. That means if you can realize independent measurement of mass and radius, then what you can do is you can plot the measurement point with some error ellipse around this. And you can say that if this hypothetical measurement is realized, then you can say that, oh, well, this magenta one is ruled out because this magenta chain equilibrium state is not consistent with this observation. Current situation is radius has been favored around 12 kilometers with uncertainty of 20%-ish. So the measurement accuracy of radius is not that good. That's why we don't know which equilibrium state is the correct one. But we do know that the massive neutron star with reliable accuracy has been observed to be a two solar mass. So that observation has already ruled out this PS equilibrium state, for example, because this equilibrium state cannot support two solar mass neutron star. Now, this is one motivation for looking at neutron stars. Another motivation is, but the problem here is that, so we want to measure mass and radius very accurately, but if you consider X-ray observations, then those like profile, X-ray pulse profile, depends not only on mass and radius that we really want to measure, but also on other quantities like moment of inertia or quadrupole moment, because neutron stars are rotating. So there are degeneracies among those parameters which deteriorates the accuracy of measuring mass and radius that we really want to measure. So that's one problem. Okay, another aspect of looking at neutron stars is thanks to its large compactness, we can probe strong field gravity using neutron stars. This is one example showing mass and radius relation for APR equilibrium state, which corresponds to this red one in GR, for some specific non-GR theory. This theory has a coupling parameter. If you set that to zero, then you recover GR. So this red one here has coupling parameter being zero. This red one is exactly the same as this red one in the left panel. But if you pick this coupling parameter to be something else, then you can see that mass radius relation now deviates from the GR one, which means that if you know which equilibrium state is the correct one, then you can constrain non-GR theories using mass and radius relation. But of course, there's big uncertainty here. There is a degeneracy between uncertainties in nuclear physics and gravitational physics. In other words, we don't know which equilibrium state is the correct one. So just by looking at mass radius relations, we cannot really tell whether one equilibrium state is correct or one theory is favored compared to GR. And so there's this degeneracy here.
So this is under the assumption that whatever the equation of state you pick, so you model it as an equilibrium system, right? Is that a reasonable approximation? There is no, any dynamical phenomena that occurs inside the
It depends on what kind of system you look at, but if you consider binary pulsars, then they are far apart. So,
But even inside, I mean, you have a ball of gas, effects. Mm-hmm. There can be various diffusion convection properties, mm-hmm. which are dynamic phenomena. People assume that, you know, just binary part, just neutron star,
isolated neutron star.
I understand it, model it as a gas in equilibrium. So my question is that a reasonable assumption? Or I mean, that looks to me potential ambiguities here are much. Has it been studied, or it's?
I think Eric has studied the internal motion, how the internal motion affects the neutron star observables, like a tidal love number, which I'll explain later on.
I think by and large, we're operating with set of systems. A very young neutron star, of course, will have all of those internal dynamics going on, but after some time, because there's viscosity inside, it settles down for the lifetime of the system.
Well, if you want to consider like proton neutron stuff, then here those equation state are cold equation state, so they don't have any temperature dependence. But if you want to look at proton neutron stuff, then they are hot, and they have some dynamical feature inside. So for those systems, these equation state won't be a good approximation. Since there are degeneracies. That's why universal relations, the relations that do not depend sensitively on internal structure or equation state, help us to break some of these degeneracies. So here is the outline of my talk. I would like to explain three different universal relations. The first one has a rather funny name. We named it as I love Q relations. These are relations among I, love, and Q quantities that I'll explain in a minute. And the second one is the approximate neutron star Noether-like relations among neutron star multiple moments. And the third one is those we recently found and we are currently working on. Those are relations among tidal parameters that enter inside the gravitational waveform emitted from neutron star binaries. And before concluding, I would like to give some discussion about possible relation between transition from a neutron star to a black hole to actual condensed matter physics second order phase transitions, although that's just a discussion. Okay, so first I'll explain what I love relations are based on these two papers. So to get started, I need to explain what I love and Q are. I stands for moment of inertia. This tells you how fast an object can spin for a given angular momentum. If you have large moment of inertia, then you can only spin slowly. And this is the quantity that a figure skater changes to his or her spinning rate by shrinking or stretching his or her arms. Now, Q here in I love Q relation corresponds to quadrupole moment, in particular, spin-induced quadrupole moment. So if you have a spinning object, then it has a quadrupolar deformation that's encoded in this Q here. Tidal love number shows tidal deformability of an object. This is defined by the ratio between tidally induced quadrupole moment due to tidal field made by some companion. And if you have large tidal love number, that means you can more easily squash an object compared to those with smaller tidal love number. So what we did was we extracted these quantities by constructing neutron star solutions, and then looked at relations among these quantities with various equation states. So to extract these quantities, we in particular constructed slowly rotating neutron star solutions or tidally deformed neutron star solutions by solving Einstein equations numerically. And then we extracted these quantities by looking at the asymptotic behavior of the metric at spatial infinity. I'll skip the details, but I will explain some of the assumptions that we made. So we assumed that the tidal deformation is small and static, so there's no dynamical tidal deformation. We neglected magnetic fields, and we assumed that the rotation is uniform and slow, so there's no differential rotation here, and neutron stars are not rapidly rotating. And we assume that the equation of state is barotropic and also isotropic. You might think there are too many assumptions here, but it depends on what kind of system you want to look at. And for example, if you want to conserve binary pulsars, then these assumptions turn out to be quite good because they only rotate slowly. And from the spin down rate, we know that magnetic field strength is rather small compared to those for magnetars. So this is the result. The top panel here shows the relation between I, moment of inertia, and lav, tidal lav number. We normalize these quantities by using the neutron star mass for various equation state. Different colors correspond to different equation state. And so if you pick, for example, APR, you get a curve here. And single parameter along the curve is mass or compactness. If you increase your mass or compactness, then you go from right to left. So you can see that no matter which equation state you pick, one equation state relation lies on top of each other, which means that this relation is insensitive to the equation state. In the bottom panel, I show the fractional difference between these data points and the fit that we created, which shows the EOS variation of these relations. And you can see that typically the maximum EOS variation in these relations are of order a few percent. A similar relation can be seen between quadrupole moment and tidal lav number. Again, the EOS variation is kept within a few percent accuracy. After we found these relations, many people, including ourselves, went on to relax some of these assumptions. And it turned out that in some cases, universality is kept, but in other cases, universality is lost. So it, again, depends on what kind of system you want to consider. Now I'll explain two important applications of these ILAV correlations to probe fundamental physics. One application is on nuclear physics side. Let's imagine that you have a neutron star with a hot spot, and this neutron star is rotating. So we see pulse profile with X-ray observations. We already see this kind of pulse profiles using current X-ray telescopes. Now, again, such pulse profile depends not only on mass and radius, but those profiles depend also on moment of inertia, quadrupole moment, and maybe other higher multiple moments, depending on how fast these neutron stars are spinning. And there are strong degeneracies among these parameters, which again deteriorate the measurement accuracy of mass and radius that we want to measure to probe nuclear physics or constrain equation state. So that's why universal relations are useful. For example, if you use I correlation, then you can eliminate Q from your parameter set. And that is because no matter which equation state you believe in, we know that I can be expressed in terms of Q and also mass. With that,
there is already an assumption that we're trying to measure that people in nuclear physics can construct this equation of states based on some physics. So they think they can control it and extrapolate it.
Yeah.
So the fact that all these equation of states turn out to be
universal,
saying something fundamental to the non-dependency of this combination of the equation of state, or about the lack of imagination of the equation of state.
Yes, of course, we cannot rule out such a possibility. Yeah. Those universal relations hold only for a fraction of equation state that we looked at. Yeah.
This particular example, it's exactly where you believe that there should be something more than just equilibrium equation of state. I mean, this is really not some of the equilibrated system. So you have a, you have a hot spot, and so everything you discussed before, in particular, the universality of the relation shouldn't be applicable to
Do you mean because there should be dynamics?
I mean, yeah, of course, there's going to be a thermal transfer, right? So it's not a
complicated
system if you have, you know.
But the influence of this magnetic field is extremely minor. So it's
But then how is the difference of before he said there is this universal thing? So,
well, in standard models, you think that there is some magnetic field that is being produced by the system,
particularly influence, you can take the ratio of the, say, the binding energy of the star versus the energy of the binding field, and then they are different by 8 orders of magnitude or more.
This is like sort of small perturbation.
It's extremely small perturbation. And then in the other case, when people study this stability of the stationary configuration, then you study perturbations, of course. And then you have this stable branch. So the assumption is you stay close.
The situation will change if you consider magnetars, where you have 10 to 16 or 17 Gauss. Then, like quadrupole moment, will be dominated by magnetic fields and not by spin rotation. So in that case, Euler correlation gets shifted. But for typical neutron stars, the magnetic field strength is 10 to 12 Gauss. And for millisecond power stars, it's smaller, like 10 to 9 Gauss. So for those, magnetic fields won't affect Euler correlations. And so in this sense, you can break some of the degeneracies among parameters. And this allows us to measure mass and radius more accurately. To give you a specific example, Psaltis and others used universal relations and estimated how accurately you can measure mass and radius from this kind of system using future X-ray telescopes such as NICER, which has already been funded by NASA and is planned to be launched next year, or our LOFT telescope, which is ESA-led telescope, but that hasn't been funded yet. So from a pulse profile, you can actually extract different kind of observables. And what they're claiming is that mass and radius should be able to be constrained to the region that where these four different bands overlap, like in this tiny region here, where radius can be measured to like 5% accuracy, which is exactly the goal of NICER or LOFT. So this is one application of using universal relations to probe fundamental physics, nuclear physics.
So they can do this for different equilibrium states. They don't need universal relations. Different equilibrium states, and they can still do the same calculation.
Well, if you do that, then there are degeneracies between mass and radius and like ion tune, so on. So these bands would be larger. They actually used universal relations, including IQ, but there are other universal relations. And then they eliminated some of the parameters here, which breaks degeneracies. And that makes these bands to get narrower. Yeah. Although they didn't show the case where they haven't used universal relations. And that's because if you increase your parameters, then it gets more and more complicated. It takes more time to calculate these profiles and then do these kind of analysis to get these errors. Because what they need to do is they need to do ray tracing analysis. And if you have these other quantities in your parameter set, then it looks, it gets more complicated. Okay, another application is on gravitational physics side, namely strong field tests of gravity. So let's imagine that with future radio observations, especially double binary pulse observations, we can get moment of inertia to 10% accuracy. And imagine that from future gravitational wave observations, we get tidal lab number to 40% accuracy. Then what you can do is you take this ILAV plane, and then this black curve is the ILAV relation in GR. And you can draw hypothetical measurement with some error box corresponding to these hypothetical observations. Now, this black one is the relation in GR. And in general, if you pick some other gravitational theory, then you get relation that's different from this GR one. So imagine that you picked some specific gravitational theory, and then you picked some specific coupling constant, and you got this red line as your new ILAV relation. Then this coupling parameter is still allowed from this measurement because this red line is consistent with this error box. But if you further increase your coupling parameter, and if you got this blue one, then your coupling parameter is now marginally allowed, But if you further crank up your parameter and you got this green one, then you can start to rule out such parameters, because now this green one is inconsistent with this observation. So in this sense, you can probe strong field gravity without being affected by the uncertainty in nuclear physics. So from the spin orbital coupling entering at 1.5 pn order or 0.5 pn order in the advanced rate of periastron. And advanced rate of periastron itself has been measured to very high accuracy, but the problem is to measure moment of inertia, you also need to measure mass. And usually from double binary pulse observations, you use advanced rate of periastron and also like Shapiro time delay to get the mass, but if you want to measure this quantity, you cannot use advanced rate of periastron to measure mass, so you need to have two other post-Keplerian parameters to be measured with the same accuracy to get this I. That's the difficulty. This I is just for a primary pulsar. Yeah, the one that's spinning rapidly, but I think you still need. I think you still need to know both, because I said this enters at 0.5 pn order in relative to the leading advanced rate of periastron, which means that this depends on the velocity of binary, which depends on total mass of the system. So you actually need to know both masses. And also, yeah, you need to know both masses, yeah. So here is a specific example where we picked a parity violating gravity, and we set the coupling parameter in this theory to be marginally allowed from these hypothetical observations. And you can see that just like in GR relation, even in this non-GR theory, there is universality here in ILAV relation in non-GR theory. And it turned out that this coupling parameter that we picked, that's marginally allowed, is 10 to 6 times smaller than the current bound coming from solar system observations, which means that if you can realize such an observation in future, then you can place million times stronger constraints in this specific theory. And that's because we are looking at very strong field regime. And to probe this kind of theory, you need to go into very strong field. If you just look at solar system experiments, then you won't be able to place strong constraints. So this plot shows, at least for certain class of non-GR theories, universal relations can be useful in constraining such theories.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I have to say that transcendence is not a gravity of theory. Transcendence is not a gravity theory. Dynamically, that theory
seems false. Yeah, it's somewhere false.
Yeah.
If you treat this as an effective theory, and then you treat parallel. Well, but yeah, you're neglecting higher like curvature corrections.
Yeah. Fine. I just had to say. If you write down the equation of motion,
is this R verge?
I'll just blow up.
Yeah.
Regardless,
it has to start derivative.
Because it's kind of derivative. Mm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, from the effective perspective, it's.
Yeah, perspective.
Right. But of course, if you're pushing it in a strong gravity regime where those things become quarter bonds, it's just like Hilbert terms, then you're not allowed to do it. You have to include that.
Perhaps it turns.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's not. It could be a theory. Yeah, it's fine, and then you can use it to rule out. I don't know.
So this is the applications of ILAV correlations to probe nuclear physics and also strong field gravity. Now I will introduce next universal relations, which are no-Hare-like relations for neutron star multiple moments. So what are multiple moments, and why are they important? Well, they basically characterize the exterior spacetime of an object. For example, if you consider a stationary and asymmetric object, then If you look at the asymptotic behavior of TT component of the metric or gravitational potential, then you will see that it has something like this structure. If you look at the coefficient of 1 over r to the l plus 1 times pl, where pl is the Jandl polynomials, then you can, such a coefficient depends on mass multiple moments, the lth mass multiple moments. And in a similar sense, if you look at space-time dragging part of the metric, T5 component, then you can extract what's called current multiple moment. And so the question is, what are the relations between these multiple moments? That depends on which space-time you pick. If you pick car metric, then there's a well-known property that car black hole doesn't have hairs. Or strictly speaking, car black hole only has two hairs, mass and spin. There's this beautiful relation among multiple moments, which states that all the higher multiple moments can be given completely in terms of first two, mass and spin. Well, that's obvious because car spacetime only has two parameters, but the actual relation is given in this beautiful relation. For example, if you set L to be two, then you get quadruple moment to be minus ma squared. So we asked, is there a similar relation for neutron stars? And maybe you think there's no such relation because neutron stars depend on crazy internal structure that we don't know. So to address this question, we first looked at the Newtonian limit. And again, we imposed certain assumptions where rotation is uniform, and we neglected magnetic fields. And we assumed a polytropic equilibrium state where P is proportional to mass density to some power, and this N is called polytropic index. Within these assumptions, we found that multiple moments for a Newtonian polytrope is given by this expression. If you compare this against the well-known black hole relation that I've shown you in previous slide, then you can see that this new relation depends now on mass, here m, and a, here is the spin, but also on q. Q corresponds to quadruple moment.
Sorry, what is the
dn? Ah, yes, this is the coefficient that depends on the polytropic index n. So this b bar has all the equation of state dependence. Ah, yes.
So it's not like in the black hole case, mm-hmm. when you have one.
Yes. So we need to pick this n. Yes, I'll come to that. So for now, what this relation is telling us is that once you specify what this n is, then all the higher multiple moments can be given completely in terms of just the first three, mass, spin, and quadruple moment. So we call this three-hair relation instead of two-hair relation. This is a famous Japanese cartoon character who has three hairs, and his name is interestingly Kyutaro. So he perfectly represents this relation. Yes, but yes. So now the next question is, how sensitive does this coefficient depend on n? Because if, yes, so there is this hidden equation of state dependence here. And for neutron stars, n is typically from 0 to 1. And within that range, we found that at least for lower L modes, like L to be smaller than 10, then the EOS dependence of this relation is kept to be within 10%, border 10%.
Can you assume here slow rotation or is spin rotation?
We didn't assume slow rotation. Yeah, rotational dependence cancels out, but yeah, in some sense they are encoded in higher multiple moments because they depend on rotation. So, yes, this is intermittent. Yes. So you might think, well, does this relation hold also for neutron stars in relativistic regime? And for example, we assumed polytropic index and we kept n from 0 to 1, but is that approximation good? So what we did next was to check that analytic Newtonian relation. We constructed neutron star solutions, rotating neutron star solutions in full GR using realistic equation state instead of polytropic equation state. And we constructed both slowly rotating and rapidly rotating solutions. And we extracted multiple moments up to hexadecapole order, or M4. These plots show relations among multiple moments. The top left shows relation between octopole and quadrupole. Right top panel shows the relation between hexadecapole and quadrupole. And just like in LFQ relation, you can see that these relations are also insensitive to the equation state, except if you look at bottom panels, which show the EOS variation. Now you see that the EOS variation is over order 10% and not a few percent. So the EOS variation is larger than the LFQ relations. And this 10% variation is actually consistent with what we found in the Newtonian limit. And if you compare these numerically calculated relations in FuGr against the analytic Newtonian relation, which is shown in dashed line here and also here, it's hard to see. In these planes, as you go to right, then you approach the Newtonian limit. So you can see that as you approach such a limit, then these data points agree beautifully with these dashed lines here and here that show Newtonian relation I've shown you in previous slides. So we confirmed at least to a hexadecapole order neutron star moment. Multiple moments can be given in terms of the first three. This M2 here has been normalized by using the black hole value. And black hole value, as I said, is minus MA squared. So that depends on mass and spin as well. So this M2 bar actually depends on all of quadrupole moment, mass, and spin.
Can you the Q is the asymptotic value of A, etc.
Practically, it's difficult to measure quadrupole moment of a neutron star.
M4.
If Q cannot be measured, then higher multiple moments won't be measured. So, this has less application compared to LFQ relations, but.
I want to use it for something else. So you know that. So outside a spherical object, the metric between is Schwarzschild. The solution outside the rotating star is not curved. But I want to connect those two. Because you're saying at least where there's a regime where solar rotation where you can use. So I know a relation like this works for curve. Now you're proposing a different relation for even star and where I can see the two coming together in some sense, or use it to define my non-curve-like behavior of the space and myself rotating star.
What do you exactly mean by curve-like behavior?
So if I'm at infinity, I measure three or four moments. As you said, then I can tell the second and third, or third and fourth quadrupole moments, I can predict on the first two, then I know if the correlation is successful. So now you're proposing something else. And I just want to know if there's a way to connect these two, and then it's a good one. If the failure to obey this particular relation and satisfy these other ones, then somehow measuring how far I am from the space time in the square curve.
Somewhat related. I'm interested in looking. Finding similar relations for like boson stars or exotic objects, then if you can measure like mass and spin and quadrupole and octopole, then you can test this three-hair relation and say that the object that you measured is consistent with boson stars or black holes or neutron stars. So yeah, in that sense, these relations can be useful, but that's something like LISA type measurement where you have extreme mass ratio systems.
On the plots that you had on the next page, you don't have a plot how the black hole relation
look like. Black hole relation just corresponds to point here because I have normalized these quantities to be the black hole value, so it just becomes point here and point here, 1, 1.
Yeah, so in terms of measuring Q, I remember years ago Sharon Morsink, but I'm sure others were involved in doing analysis of X-ray data. And she was doing something where you accounted for the surface deformation. So I think the model was that the X-rays come from the surface. That's not very accurate, but no, pretend it is. And she was concluding that the amount of deformation of the surface had an impact on the X-ray curves that you get. So that would be one way of handling the amount of deformation of the surface.
Yes, except I don't know if you can measure such deformation independently from mass and radius. Because what they do is they use this universal relation between this stellar ellipticity and compactness to eliminate this ellipticity dependence so that they can concentrate on mass and radius. Yeah, just like what I explained for the RF correlations. Yeah, so in principle, yes, but in practice, it can be difficult. Yes. So we claimed that neutron stars are not as bold as black holes, but maybe we can say they are follicly challenged. Okay, so now I'll move on to the final relations that we found recently. So as I said, by looking at gravitational wave signals, you can extract internal structure information of neutron stars. So by looking at, for example, in spiral part of neutron star binaries, gravitational waves, you can extract mass and tidal love number of a neutron star. And just like you can probe internal structure or equation of state using mass and radius relation, there is actually tidal love number mass relation that depends strongly on equation of state. So by measuring these two quantities, you can again plot some measurement point with an error ellipse, and then you can play the same game. You can say, oh, well, some of the equation states are not consistent with this gravitational wave measurement, so you can rule out these equation states. But the situation is not this simple, because to use that relation, you need to know the isolated neutron stars mass and tidal love number. But since you have two neutron stars, you have two individual tidal love numbers that enter into the gravitational waveform. To be more specific, this is this schematic expression of the gravitational waveform phase emitted from a neutron star binary. X here shows the frequency dependence, and it is proportional to velocity squared. If a term is proportional to x to the n, then that means the term is n post-Newtonian order relative to the leading piece. This expression consists of two parts, the point particle part and tidal part. And we are interested in this part. And you can see that tidal part has two tidal parameters, lambda and delta lambda, which both depend on individual tidal love numbers and also mass ratio. So since there are two independent tidal love numbers, you need to have two independent tidal parameters in your parameter set when you're doing parameter estimation of gravitational wave observations. And the combination or independent two tidal parameters are not unique. You can, if you want, pick individual tidal love numbers to be your parameters, tidal parameters, but then there will be strong degeneracy between these two parameters. That is because you can see that they both enter through lambda at 5pn order. They enter at the same order, so their correlation is very strong. On the other hand, smarter choice would be to pick lambda and delta lambda as your parameter set, because now you can see that they entered different post-Newtonian order, so the correlation is weaker.
So can you buy anything by assuming that the neutron stars are, you know, made out of the same equation of state? I mean, they're not completely independent from each other.
Completely independent.
Independent. So the equation of state can be assumed to be the same. It's just that the compaction might be different, but that probably reduces the number of independent parameters.
Yeah, but the question is how you quantify that information into this waveform here.
Doesn't that imply a relationship between them?
Yeah. I think that's what we are doing. We are trying to find relations between these two tidal parameters. Before getting to that point, I'll I want to show how well we can measure this lambda parameter with future advanced LIGO observation. Unfortunately, this delta lambda term here is typically very small, so you won't be able to measure this delta lambda in practice, but you can measure this lambda. Here, I assumed measuring these kind of gravitational waves using advanced LIGO with some optimistic SNR, signal-to-noise ratio of 30. We picked APR, rather soft equation state, to be the correct one. We picked mass ratio to be 0.9. Then the vertical axis shows fractional measurement error of lambda parameter here. If this line is below this unity line, then that means, roughly speaking, you can measure this lambda parameter. The horizontal axis corresponds to the mass of a smaller neutron star. If smaller mass neutron star is 1.4, then you can measure this lambda to be 65% accuracy if this optimistic situation is realized.
And what's the physical reason for that? Is it because for larger masses, the radius is larger, and therefore you don't probe?
Yeah, if you have
radiation from
basically, yeah, if NY is large, then that means lab number gets smaller and it gets difficult to measure. Yeah. So now the question is, well, that lambda parameter does not have much physical meaning because it is a combination of two individual tidal lab numbers. So we ask, can we measure tidal parameters that are physically more meaningful? For example, can we actually measure individual tidal lab numbers? And can we improve the measurement accuracy of tidal lab numbers somehow? To address these questions, we yet looked at another universal relations, simply because if we can find such relations, then we can break the degeneracy between those two tidal parameters. So we think we can improve the measurement accuracy of tidal parameters. And as Eric pointed out, it is quite natural to look for these universal relations because we think that equation state of two neutron stars are the same, so there must be some relation between those two tidal parameters through the mass relation. So what we did was we picked simple combination of tidal lab numbers, the symmetric tidal parameter and anti-symmetric combination, and then we looked for relations between these two parameters and also mass ratio. So now this is the result that we found. This 3D plot shows relation between anti-symmetric combination, symmetric combination, and mass ratio for various equation state. Different colors, again, corresponds to different equation state. This plane here is the fit. So unlike in the ILFQ relation, now you have two parameters, two variables. So instead of having just a single curve, you now have a universal plane. And if you look this 3D plot from different viewpoint, like from this viewpoint here, then you can see that the relation looks something like this. So you can see that these data points, colored data points, lie on the fitted plane to some accuracy. And some accuracy, the US variation, is kept, roughly speaking, to be of order 10%, especially for lower mass neutron stars. So now I will show how we can use these relations to measure individual tidal lab numbers and improve the measurement accuracy of tidal parameters. This plot is the same as what I showed you before, the measurement accuracy of lambda, capital lambda, the commonly used parameter, tidal parameter. If you try to measure the symmetric combination without using binary, the universal relation, then what you find is that the measurement accuracy or measurement error is given something like this, which is much worse than this lambda here. And that's exactly because there is strong degeneracy between lambda S and lambda A, which deteriorates the measurement accuracy of lambda S. But since you have universal relation, you can break this degeneracy. And now you find that lambda S can be measured to be this error, which is slightly better than the commonly chosen tidal parameter. And so now you have this lambda S, and through the universal relation, you can automatically get lambda A. So you now have two independent tidal parameters. And from these two, you can actually reconstruct the individual tile love numbers. So for example, if you can realize this measurement, then you can get the tidal love number of a smaller neutron star to this accuracy. So there are 2 points. One, universal relation among these two tidal parameters allow us to measure individual love numbers, and we can improve the measurement accuracy of tidal love number for this case to be like 50%. Okay, now I'll try to conclude, and before concluding, I would like to give some discussion. So yes, this is the same plot as I showed you before, the Noether-like relation for a neutron star, for photically challenged neutron star, and as I said, black hole corresponds to this point here. So we decided to look into this region in more detail and see how these multiple moments and also moment of inertia approach the black hole limit. This plot shows fractional difference in moment of inertia from the black hole value as a function of fractional difference in compactness from a black hole value. The black hole limit corresponds to 0, 0 in this plane. So as you go to bottom left, you approach the black hole limit. Here I show the relation for various equation state. And what I would like you to notice is that they more or less have similar slope. So we try to extract the slope of each curve using this fitting form. And we found that this scaling exponent on average has roughly a value of 4 with some EOS variation that's of order 10%. We did similar analysis for quadruple moment and octuple moment, and we found similar result. So this shows that there is EOS universality in the scaling exponent within 10%. And this sounds, in some sense, similar to what happens in second order phase transition. For example, if you consider ferromagnetism, then if you have a system with temperature that's above Curie temperature, you are in this ordered phase. But if you go below, you enter into ordered phase. And then this transition can be expressed in terms of magnetic susceptibility being proportional to temperature minus Curie temperature, the critical temperature to some power. And this exponent is called critical exponent. And there is a well-known fact that critical exponent shows universal behavior in the sense that this parameter here, the value, actual value, does not depend on which system you look at. This is just a discussion. I don't have anything.
Yes, I object. there's no black hole limit, right? So there's no way that you can actually, as you would for a critical point, approach the critical point, and really be close enough to the critical temperature to measure the exponent.
If you consider anisotropic source, then you can reach the black hole limit in terms of compactness. Well, mathematically, yes.
But these are like a parameterization. You parameterize one observable as a power with respect to another that doesn't imply any phase transition.
Right.
What are the two phases? I mean, there, as you said, typically when there is a phase transition, there is an order parameter. So what exactly is the phase that you distinguish?
The state is different neutron star. One is neutron star, and the other one is black hole. And if you want, you can pick order parameter to be maybe compactness, where you increase your compactness, and if you reach compactness,
it's
to be
not more. Really an order parameter. It's more like what you were saying is how much hair your neutron star has compared to the core. So that's...
Yeah. I was telling Lewis, but there are papers where they looked at neutron stars in ADS context, and they So they looked at neutron star ADS solution and black hole ADS solution, and they calculated CFT operator, corresponding CFT operator on the boundary, and they found that neutron star operator corresponds to high density baryonic state code, baryonic state, and the black hole operator corresponds to thermal gluon state. So in the CFT side, it looks like there's a phase transition between state that can be mapped to the transition from a neutron star to a black hole. Although,
how you can compare, and usually phase transitions happens, okay, first we need to discuss if you are in a canonical ensemble, right, at a fixed temperature. Now, black hole phase, of course, has a temperature.
Yes.
Now, yes. Any neutron star configuration constructed in ADS has no temperature.
I don't think so. That well,
different temperature. So you know what's less
and
what do you mean by phase?
Well, we don't really know that. Yeah, and in actual phase transition, there's this scale invariance and correlation lengths being divergent. We don't know what those are in a gravitational side. So, yes.
But it seems to me that instead of searching for some kind of universality in a black hole limit that doesn't exist according to Lewis, what you're really finding is what happens near maximum mass. Because the endpoint of each curve is the maximum mass configuration. And maybe there's something about the maximum mass configuration that gives you, the universality of some sort.
Yeah, I don't exactly remember if I stopped at the maximum mass or if I went further. Because if you want, you can construct a solution.
You would be misguided.
Yeah. It's unrealistic, but this situation itself is unrealistic because this is equilibrium sequence and not the actual gravitational collapse. So.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the vertical axis? What is that?
This shows the fractional difference in moment of inertia from the black hole body.
Fractional difference in what?
In moment of inertia.
Moment of inertia. So should we, I have similar questions, but maybe, I kind of think it is like a phase transition forming a black hole, but it's more like a first order. In my mind, I've always thought it was more like a first order phase transition.
From a neutron star to black hole?
For example.
Why is that? Why do you say so? If that's the case, then all the formula has to diverge at the critical point.
Nothing should diverge in the first order phase transition. But anyway,
discontinued. Absolutely.
This continues. Mm-hmm. But should we be surprised? I mean, that the black hole is actually that this trajectory seems to run into the black hole.
Do you think it's strange?
Yeah, to me it seems strange. At least I don't understand why that should be the case.
Well, I mean,
because there's a huge
presumably the endpoint is a large mass, so maybe in the limit of infinitely large mass. This is sort of the UV observable, the far away asymptotic observable, so everything would look like a black hole. So maybe
it's not large.
If
you've gone over the maximum mass, you're actually increasing the mass.
The endpoint is not really.
If we consider only the slowly rotating case, again, the same observation would. I go back to what I was saying before. Okay, so we know that the solution outside is being like a short shield solution, if we're measuring things that are asymptotic, and it's not surprising that we get something that's close to the new black hole. That's why.
What is it? The moment of inertia.
Right, so it's looking at very high speeds, but the speeds are not necessarily that high, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And so maybe all these 10%, 20% of flow here and there is okay. The difference between the current solution and the true solution that is outside is solid. And therefore, given that the current solution is outside.
Suppose we were even doing structures, would we expect to see? I don't know what you would plot, I suppose. Maybe it's not a well-planned question.
Right, it's zero sports show distance. But
Yeah, in this lane, black hole corresponds to zero and zero because we are taking the difference from the black hole.
I mean, you can take a system, some of the StatMax system where just choose two. I mean, pretty much, you know, if I look at your holotropic equation of state, you're not going to call it a phase transition, right? It's just a parametrization of pressure versus, you know, versus density. So it's exactly...
No, if you want to explain the phase transition, it's in the sense of space-time. The space-time phase transition, they went from knowing that you had a star to essentially going to...
So you're thinking something dynamic, so there was a star and then collapses.
Well, in configuration space. That goes to what Eric was concerned about. Big picture, please. At some point, once you get close to an area where you're very close to the black hole, then it needs to be
the black hole is a point there.
It's in the sphere of the outside. It's not.
Usually, you know, I have two phases. Mm-hmm. I have something, something to dial in the other phase.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So here, you know, that's more like a parameterization than choosing the origin and the origin.
Yeah, I agree with I also have the same thing, about
what is C by the way, sorry?
Compactness.
Basically rate is
well muscle.
So we don't know. But
just as so you don't feel bad. So 2 weeks ago I was giving a talk somewhere else, I was showing something with something else, but someone said, well, you have to be careful that if you don't see a table with four legs, and you see a cat with four legs, and then you conclude that the cat and the table are related. So you asked me that question, so that's fine.
I guess we have to discuss it. So the takeaway is, we found three different universal relations. The first one is ILFQ. The second one is Noether-like relations for neutron stars. And the third one is relations among two tidal parameters that entering gravitational waves emitted from neutron subbinaries. And they can be useful in probing fundamental physics, like nuclear physics and gravitational physics. I didn't have time to explain, but they are also useful in probing astrophysics, like measuring independent spins of neutron stars. And there is a possibility that these relations can help in looking at cosmology through measuring tidal Love number. So, yeah. So, you know that gravitational wave and neutron star sources can be used as standard sirens to probe cosmology. The problem here is that you need to measure luminosity distance and redshift independently. Luminosity distance, you can measure from amplitude, but redshift, you cannot. So you use electromagnetic counterparts, but you don't have well enough localization accuracy to pinpoint the source host galaxy, so it's difficult to get redshift. Now, the reason why we cannot get redshift is because redshift degenerate with the mass. So we can only measure redshifted mass. Now, tidal Love number has dependence on neutron star mass, and that mass is the intrinsic mass, not the redshifted mass. So by measuring, if you know which equation of state is correct, then by measuring Love number, you can get the information about the intrinsic mass, and by combining redshift mass, you can get, the redshift. So, we didn't propose that. That's it.
Questions? Maybe round two about this discussion. There's any other question?
I made mine.
Huh?
I made mine.
Okay, so Ken is here for one more day.
Yeah.
I'm in office 268, if anyone wants to grab me. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.